Hi, this is Betty Corwin. I'm the director and former creator of Theatre on Film and Tape, an archive that exists at the library at Lincoln Center. I'm going to be talking to Rabbi Saul Solomon of Dave's Gone By radio program on UNC Radio.
Oh, shalom, my friends. This is your old pal, Rabbi Saul Solomon, the founder and spiritual leader of Temple Sons of Bitches in Great Neck, New York. And boy, oh boy, you know, just like the host of this program, Dave, I love the theater. But theater, unfortunately, tends to be evanescent. It's there for a little while, and then when the show closes, it's gone, goodbye, forever. However, every once in a while, if you're lucky, there's preservation involved. We have the cast albums, we have interviews with the people who are in the show and made the show, and the photographs. But also, over the past several years, people have been archiving and saving the actual whole performances of productions on and off Broadway. And the woman who spearheaded this back in 1969 is with us on the telephone right now. She won a Lifetime Achievement Award this past week from the League of Professional Theater Women, and in 2001 she even got a special Tony Award. So won't you please welcome to the neighborhood, Betty Corwin. Shalom, Betty.
Thank you so much for that lovely introduction.
Oh, well, thank you for giving so much to us lovers of the theater. So, of course, I have to ask you, take us through. You weren't even thinking of theater terms. You were like a psychiatric social worker when the idea...
I wasn't a psychiatric social worker.
Oh.
I was a volunteer at the hospital in the Bronx. Whatever the hospital was, and I was working there a couple of times a week as a volunteer. And it was when the Rockefeller Foundation announced through the hospital that they were going to be offering paraprofessional training for a few women to be selected from the hospital, that I became interested in that program.
And so, there was a program already at Lincoln Center, or how did you go?
There was such a program, and this was a continuation of a training program for paraprofessional psychiatric social workers.
But you were filling out the application, you were filling out the form, and what happened?
I decided I would do that, and so I had to appear before the board, I had to be interviewed, and then I had to write a brief autobiography. And when I started to do that, I was typing about my parents, my brother, my schools, and then suddenly I found myself saying, wait a minute, the most exciting time of my life was when I used to work in the theater. So what am I doing here? So I never finished the autobiography. I thanked the woman who started the program, and I said, Agnes, thank you very much for helping me find out what I really want to do.
But let me ask you, what had you done in the theater prior to that?
Okay. Well, in the 1940s, when my husband was overseas, we had just been married, and he was gone. He was in the invasion of Normandy and really in heavy stuff. But I got a job working for Martin Gable, the producer. And I worked for him for a couple of years until he went to California. I worked for Paula Stone, and I worked for Carly Wharton. They were all producers.
What did you do for them?
Oh, okay. I was what was called a production assistant script reader. I did a lot of script reading for the producer, and the production assistant was a job you mostly did when they did a show, and you'd go backstage or wherever they were to assist them and make notes and do whatever it was to help them along.
Now, can I ask you, when in the 1940s and 50s, when you were working for Martin Gable and these other producers, and these scripts came across to you first before you handed the good ones up to the producers on the higher level, were there shows that you green lit, essentially, like you were the first yes on shows that we would remember now?
Well, most of those shows were really duds.
Oh, okay.
And I didn't recommend them, but any that showed any promise that sounded interesting to me, I would recommend to Martin Gable, the producer. And that's when he would follow up on it.
So even if it was half a dud, you'd say, oh, this is has some good stuff in it. Why don't you read it? And maybe he'd produce it.
Correct.
Wow. Well, what were some of those shows? Do you remember?
Oh, well. Well, one that he produced was called The Assassins by Irwin Shaw. Ooh. And he actually had done shows even before I worked for him. He had worked, I guess he had invested in Life with Father, which was a very good investment at the time. But aside from The Assassins, I'm trying to think of some of the other shows. Can't think of titles right now.
Okay. Well, do you have any funny, amusing backstage stories of those years in the 40s when he had shows up and you were running around backstage?
Well, I was running around front stage and backstage with Martin Gable.
Okay.
Well, let's see what happened. Funny stories?
Or amusing or touching or just interesting because it was somebody really famous.
Yeah. Well, I will tell you that with The Assassins, which was not a success, it was very interesting bringing it to Broadway because Irwin Shaw was such a remarkable, successful novelist, but here he was writing a Broadway show. And unfortunately, it didn't make it to Broadway.
That happens? That, you know, it closed out of town, you're saying?
No, closed in town.
Oh.
Closed in New York.
They had an off-Broadway back then?
No, well, they may have had, or they did have off-Broadway. But the show was not produced off-Broadway. It was produced on Broadway.
But you just said it didn't make it to Broadway, I thought.
No, it did not make it, period.
Oh, you mean it flopped. It failed. Oh, that happens.
Not a success.
Yeah, okay. Now I got it. Now, hey, can I ask you, those early years when you were working for these producers, did you have a script in your drawer that you hoped they would read, or you never even tried that?
No, I was not a script writer.
So what did you look for in other people's scripts?
Well, when I got to college, I majored in English and drama and read a lot of scripts, and I looked for something that was appealing, something that would be exciting on stage, that had good performances.
Okay. Now, why did you stop working for those people? Your husband came home? Was that the deal?
Yeah, after a couple of years, my husband came home from Europe. He had been in the invasion of Cherbourg. And I continued to work for a little while we got settled in the city. But let's see, it was 1951, I think it was, when we moved to Connecticut. My husband was a young doctor, just starting in practice. Once he got through that little initial business of opening an office and so forth, he decided he really wanted to be a doctor in the country. They preferred that. And that was when we moved to Connecticut.
And that made it impossible for you to go back and forth 4 or 5 days a week.
I was not interested at that point.
Okay. All right.
Commuting.
But how long, and so it was what, the late 60s when you decided, oh, I don't want to do this psychology thing. I want to get back to the theater.
No. I did a lot of things when we first moved to Connecticut. First of all, I started with a couple of other people, a wonderful little bookstore, which was dedicated to social issues and political issues. And we arranged for busloads to go to Washington. As a matter of fact, we were at the event where Martin Luther King said he had a dream. And other events, social events, when LBJ was running for president, and I did help arrange for those bus rides, and it was a very exciting time because the bookstore was a wonderful place with wonderful books about political, social, activist issues.
You must be having a miserable time since the last election, though.
I am. Definitely am.
Are you still? Are you still political at all?
Am I what?
Are you still political?
I am political, but not as active as I was when I was young.
Not that it's nice to ask a woman her age, but are you in fact 96 years old?
I'm almost 97. Next week, November 19th, I'll be 97.
I have to say, I saw a video clip of you receiving that award from the League of Professional Theater Women over at Sardi's this past week, and you do not look 97 years. I mean, you have to a little help walking across the room, but still, you know, mazel tov, you look in good shape.
Well, thank you very much.
Are you? How is your health? Are you good?
My health is good. My walking is not good.
So, but do you live by yourself? Do you live in assisted, or how do you manage? Do you have children helping you?
My children are all grown and out of the house and have their own wonderful careers. I have a wonderful woman friend who lives with me and helps me out.
Oh, that's huge. That's because you're still in Connecticut, right? You're not in New York.
I live in Weston, Connecticut.
Okay, lovely, lovely. So, all right, getting back to, though, so you're at the bookstore, right? But
yeah, and then I worked for the Red Cross, I worked for the schools. I did a lot of volunteer work while my children were growing up. And it wasn't until the last couple of years that I felt that I could not have to be home all the time that I started doing work at the hospital.
But again, you were filling out that form, and then you say, I'm doing my biography or autobiography, and then you say, I want to be back in the theater. How did you get back in the way that you did?
Aha.
Aha.
That is the question, Rabbi Saul.
I can say, oh, I would love to work in the theater too, but you have one of the best jobs ever. How did you get it?
Okay. Well, I went into New York the day after I had decided not to apply for that job at the hospital. And I visited people I had worked with in the theater. And it was actually my sister-in-law, who was an agent at William Morris at the time, who said to me, why don't you try to preserve shows on film? And I kind of laughed and I said, well, that's a very fun idea, but I doubt I can do it. She said, why don't you give it a try? I went to sleep that night, woke up the next morning and thought, nothing ventured, nothing gained. And I went immediately to the New York Public Library for the Performing Arts, and I met with the person in charge of the drama department there, proposed my idea to him. He said, well, what makes you think you could do that? People have tried and they've never succeeded. I said, well, I don't know if I can do it, but I sure want to try. And I do know that before I can do anything, I have to have approval from at least a half a dozen unions. Actors' Equity, the Dramatists Guild, the Society of Directors and Choreographers, the Stagehands, the Musicians, and so on. And he said, well, we'll give you a desk and a telephone and 3 months to get the project off the ground. But no money. You'll have to raise your own money.
Oh, you gewalt. Okay.
Well, I thought about that because it was easy for me not to need money. My husband was the moneymaker in the family. He was a physician with a successful practice and very supportive of me, so that I knew that I could start this.
All right. And you made some phone calls first. I mean, just dealing with all those unions.
Well, don't think I did it all at one time. Actually, in 3 months, I really didn't get much done. I was lucky the library kept me on. But in 3 months, I did get Actors' Equity. So I had one union.
Well, that's a huge one, though. They're big. I mean, that's a major feather in the cap, okay?
It was a major accomplishment, and I was very proud of it and glad that I could start working on the other unions as well, because once you say, we have Actors' Equity, they'll listen to you a little bit. And so that was how I began with the unions. And let's see, it took 2 years. To get the Dramatists Guild and the Society of Directors and Choreographers.
What were they so afraid of? Was it that people would not go to shows because they could sit in the library and watch them?
It was one thing.
Yeah.
I know, for example, with the Musicians Union, they were very frightened of piracy because there'd been a lot of it with the musicians. You know, they had people come into the theater with some little audio thing and they would tape off the music and then suddenly it would be on some radio program. It was, just didn't trust me.
So what would you say was the tipping point in your favor? What did you tell these other unions after Actors Equity when they finally said, oh, all right?
Well, they didn't just say, oh, I had to plead with them and write them and call them, and it was not easy. They didn't really respond too well for a while. But little by little, they did come around because, let me tell you first, before I went to these last two unions, which were the actors, Stagehands Union and the Musicians Union.
Okay.
That before that, I really had to struggle to get through to those unions. And I thought, you know, I've got to have something to show. And I knew I could do an off-Broadway show without union affiliations.
And you could have done a non-musical. You know, just to show...
Well, yeah. I couldn't do a non-musical because I couldn't do any show on Broadway.
Okay.
But I did decide to go to off-Broadway, and I taped a little rock musical called Golden Bat.
Golden Bat? Okay.
At the Sheridan Square Theater on 8th Street. And what I did was I advertised for a cameraman. I still didn't have much money, but I did have a little. And the person who answered, who was the cheapest cameraman in New York, was the one I hired. His name was Bob Brady. He had his own camera. And we went down to the Sheridan Square Theater, and he sat there, totally stoned, with a haze of smoke in his head, but we taped our first show.
No, wait, was the theater, was the play about smoking pot and they were all stoned and the whole theater?
No, or he was nothing at all. It was a very adorable little Japanese rock musical, but my cameraman was totally stoned.
You were very, I can't believe they allowed that. Well, all right. And
nobody allowed it, but he just did it.
Well, by the way, is that... Golden Bat, is that video still in your collection? Is that watchable to people who go to Lincoln Center?
Of course.
Wow. Wow.
It's number one in the collection.
Now, here's a complaint that I have. I went to the website for New York Public Library the Performing Arts, and you can search for things, but there's no place where you can just get a list of the 4,000-plus videos that you have, now Patrick Hoffman is running it, but of the 4,000 videos in that collection, you can do a global search for the library, but I can't find a place where you can just sort of skim and browse and say, oh, they have this. Oh, I never heard of that. You ought to do that.
Yeah, well, I'm afraid I don't know the answer to that, because I know that they keep very good records at the library, and certainly I would think that the website would have a list of all our shows. You know, we have 7,000 titles.
Oh, I thought it was 4,000. Now it's 7?
Well, 4,000 shows, 7,000 titles, because in addition to shows, we have interviews and dialogues and theater-related television shows, and those make up half of the 7,000.
Now, let me ask you, as you said in that first show, I can't keep myself from saying the Golden Bat, but after a few years after that, is it still a one-camera, fixed-position thing, or in recent years have you been able to do two or three-camera with a mixer, so it's a little more...
You've heard of Hal Prince?
I've heard of Hal Prince, yes.
Hal Prince was producing Company, and we were taping it. And when we did it with one camera, he realized that that was really not very effective. So he went to Equity on our behalf. And he was the one who broke the Equity rule. And Equity, after that, allowed us to use as many cameras as we needed. We used 5 for The Lion King. We used 4 for the Chorus Line Gala celebration. So that it was no longer a one-camera shoot.
But what about audio? Because it's fine if you're using 5 cameras, but if they're positioned in the back of the room, can you go through the soundboard, or are you still catching audio just from what's coming on stage?
Well, we have a sound man who's really excellent. We have actually more than one, but one guy who worked for us many years. And we have a video truck.
Oh, wow.
The video truck... you've seen them outside the theater, I'm sure. Sits outside the theater. And inside it are all these monitors, one for each of the cameras. The video director sits there. This video sound man has been in the house setting up sound equipment for the show and bringing the sound into the video truck.
This is so different from that guy, the stone guy, sitting there in that little off-Broadway theater with one camera and a seat. I mean, it's a professional operation, as it were.
Well, this is a totally professional operation. The sound man, the video director, the person who watches over the electronics, all sit in the video truck supervising every minute of the taping.
Now, is this different from when, you know, this year especially, great performances on public television has been broadcasting a bunch of Broadway shows? They've been doing Present Laughter, they'll be doing Falsettos, they did that She Loves Me from last year, and they'll be doing Indecent, the Paula Vogel play. Well, are those different still? Are your videos similar to those, or is there still kind of a difference between what you're allowed to do?
Because what we're trying to get is, I guess we call it a study print. What we want is to catch the show as you would watch it from the audience. On television, they use multi-cameras just as we do, but they do lots of close-ups, they do split screens, they do all sorts of technical things that we would never consider doing.
You founded this idea, the Theater on Film and Tape Archive at the New York Public Library at Lincoln Center. But, you know, we're in an era now where, you know, it's kind of funny. There was a press release in 2014 from the organization that said, oh, we're taking all these shows that were on Betamax and we're putting them on DVD. But, you know, that's almost like a newspaper delivery boy switching from a pushcart to a bicycle while ignoring the Cadillac in the driveway. It's like, don't you think you should just be going straight to the leap to digital?
I'm sorry, I don't quite understand your question.
Well, what I'm saying is like, you know, if you're putting things on DVD, which is wonderful, but DVD is already being kind of phased out. Aren't we at the point where you just have things on digital files?
We don't just have things on digital files. We keep everything on file, of course, but we do tape our shows on DVD.
Okay.
And we have complete records of them. We have the shows there at the library for people to see. I think that's quite different from what you're describing.
Well, what I'm saying is people can come to the library, and instead of actually putting a hard disk into a computer and watching that, aren't we at the point where they can just go on a computer and click on a video file and watch it that way? And then you never have deterioration. You never have, what happens to tapes and even DVDs.
Well, they don't have that many shows on videotapes or that you can watch on television, I assure you. We have, as I told you, over 4,000 shows going back to 1970.
Right.
And that really makes quite a difference. And you don't just put in a DVD. We have a room, 24 television stations, so that 24 people can watch at one time. And the tape is put in downstairs, audio room, below Lincoln Center, where all the tapes are kept on file, and where you tell the person in charge of the video room, I would like to see, let's say, Company, and they would tell that person. That person will tell the person downstairs in the video room. Monitor number 3 wants to watch Company, and it will come up. Now, you can sit in front of that television set. You can adjust the sound. You can go back and forward, and you can see the tape as you wish. But you never touch the tape itself. We never make copies of the tapes. We have masters that are preserved. We make a copy only for preservation purposes if something should happen to the original tape and it should start to deteriorate.
Right, exactly. I mean, I imagine you'll get a lot more people looking for the 1975 video that you have of A Chorus Line and of Company from 1970 than you will of some pretty forgotten musicals and plays that you've also taped. So I imagine those particular, especially, you've got a sacrosanct master copy.
We show people the viewing copy.
Yes, yes.
There's one copy that is preserved.
Yes.
One copy that's used for viewing.
Got it. So would you go to these shows, plays and musicals, on and off Broadway, and you would make the decision as what to keep and what not to?
Yes. The answer to that is yes. But now, I'm no longer the director of the archive. I think I don't know if I mentioned that I resigned from that job in 2001. And my trusty, wonderful assistant, whose name is Patrick Hoffman, who had been my assistant for 8 years, have taken over the job of director of the archive, and he's the one who makes the decision.
But when you were making those decisions, was it a point where you could have said, since your organization kept growing and now you had the money, that, oh, let's tape every show of this season on Broadway, or you could never make that call?
Okay. We just didn't have money to tape every show on Broadway. You had to be selective. And we had to request that occasionally the producer pay for it. Very often they do, very often they don't. But we used our money very carefully.
Now, are there shows in your archive that most ordinary people or even theater fans might not know about that you saw in the theater that you've watched on your copy that you think more people should go visit and watch?
Well, I don't think anybody should go to watch anything they're not especially interested in. Actually, the tapes are only available to students, theater professionals, and researchers. It is not available to the general public because we could never handle the crowds of people from the general public who would come to the library. And we wanted to protect the tapes. So that is our restriction. As far as people wanting to come to see something that I think they should see, I don't think that I'm in that position to say. I think anybody who wants to see something can do research and decide that's what I would like to look at.
Do you still go to the theater?
I do. I'm on the awards committee. committee for the Outer Critics Circle, and so I do get to see all the Broadway shows and a lot of off-Broadway shows.
And living in Connecticut, is it difficult for you to come in and do it? Because that's 50, 60, 70, 80 shows you got to see.
Yeah, that's a lot of shows. I go in by car. I have a driver who drives. He's not my driver, but he drives me. And he drives me, waits for me, and drives me home. I used to take the train, but that got to be hard as I got older.
Totally understandable. Can I ask, what are some of your favorite things that you have seen over the last couple of years?
Oh, let's see. The last couple of years. Well, I don't know that I can say anything for the last couple of years. Let me think. Mention a couple.
Oh, well, I mean, let's think of the shows that were up for Tonys last year. Did you see Dear Evan Hansen?
Did I see what?
Dear Evan Hansen.
Yes.
And?
And it was wonderful.
Okay, that's the kind of question I'm asking. Did you see?
Oh, yes.
Indecent.
Indecent, I had seen in New Haven and then seen again when it was produced on Broadway. It was amazing. Paula Vogel, the writer, the author, had made a lot of changes, and it was a wonderful show. And I did see it, and we did tape it. And Paula Vogel is one of my favorite playwrights. As a matter of fact, she worked for me for 2 years when she was 26 years old, years and years ago when theater on film and tape was new. She came to me and applied for a job as a secretary.
Wow.
And she got the job. And about 2 weeks later, I called her into my office and I said, Paula, you neglected to mention something in your resume. And she said, what? I said, you forgot to mention that you were teaching playwriting at Cornell.
Maybe she thought if she put that in, it wouldn't be
I know she did think that. And she said, well, that's true. I said, are you leaving? She said, no, I'm staying. And she did stay for 2 years. And she was just wonderful. I hated to lose her. But she left us to take on a job at Brown University at the head of their drama department.
Well, yeah, I couldn't understand why she would do that. Quite honestly, was there advice that you gave your successor at TOFT, at the Public Library, Patrick Hoffman? Did you tell him, when you handed the mantle over to him to run that part of the organization, was there anything you told him, you need to do this and remember this and make sure you do that?
No, but I have to laugh when you ask me that question, because when I finally had gotten approval from Stagehands Union, I was so excited that every show I did after that, every straight play, I'd go backstage and give each stagehand a Hershey bar with almonds.
All right.
And Patrick Hoffman, who became the director after me, still does that.
Oh. Well, that's lovely. I mean, I think that's a wonderful kind of backstagey tradition.
Yes, it is.
Well, I wish I could reach across the telephone lines and give you a Hershey bar with almonds, Betty Corwin. I'm going to remind folks that, yes, we're talking about the New York Public Library at Lincoln Center's Theater on Film and Tape Archive. But remember that you do have to be either a current student, as you said. When you say, how do you prove that you should be allowed to view these things?
Well, most people are honest, but they do have to sign a form saying their reason for wanting to watch. And it can't be, oh, I never saw that show, I want to see it. That's not a good reason. The reason is, well, as I mentioned, students, theater professionals, researchers. Researchers is a very big category. We had a priest who used to come because he was teaching a class on death and dying, and he came to see the O'Neill plays. he came to see.
Which one?
I'm trying to think which one. It was probably, I don't know which one. I can't remember now which one.
Yeah.
But, Whose Life Is It Anyway?
Right.
As is, plays about AIDS. He came to see all of those. Well, he was a researcher and a valid researcher.
Oh, so, but that's interesting. It wouldn't have occurred to me that it wasn't just theater researchers and people writing about theater for journals, but it's researchers who need that information, but they can be from other disciplines, as it were.
Could be artists, it could be a minister, a priest, whoever. Well, whoever really needed the information for his research.
So last question for you, Becky Corwin. What do you hope for in the next 10, 20 years for that archive?
I just hope it continues to grow and grow and grow.
Well, we wish the same for you, Becky Corwin. Good continued health to you and continued health to the program that you founded all those years ago. I thank you very, very much for being with us in the neighborhood, and I wish you shalom.
Thank you so much, Rabbi, and I'm delighted to have spoken with you.
Shalom to you.
Shalom.